This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, this week, the Environmental Film Festival, I recorded several Q&As from the Environmental Film Festival, Eugene Environmental Film Festival, at the Art House, formerly the Bijou Art House Cinema here in Eugene on the 13th. So today is Alice from Friends of Family Farmers. This is very important work they're doing to preserve family farms. You can hear my neighbor tearing up a trailer next door while I'm doing this. In the wake of the rent strike debacle that has ended, and they have a GoFundMe site, and they're looking for funding because they were evicted finally from the rent strike property, and so now they're looking to do a land trust at another location. So you can go to their EugeneRentStrike.org, EugeneRentStrike.org website, and find out about their GoFundMe site if you want to support that. And I hope you do. Because I did a call out for a history of rent strikes in Eugene, of rent abuse in Eugene, and David Zupan emailed me of Eugene Peaceworks, emailed me about Amazon student housing for the U of O that they destroyed, perfectly fine, cheap housing, and there's a history of this in Eugene, of destroying perfectly good, cheap housing so that developers and the university or other players, big players, can make more money and more profit when it was perfectly fine and could just be restored and would be sustainable the way it was. So that's in the second half. Friendsoffamilyfarmers.org. Our vision, Friends of Family Farmers envisions a local, diversified, and interconnected agricultural future built by small and mid-sized farms where people, animals, communities, and ecosystems thrive, and equitable policies improve lives and land for Oregonians.
So here's Alice. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming tonight. I wanted to tell you a little bit about our own little hometown seed sovereignty and seed diversity campaign that we have going on right now. I'm with a group called Friends of Family Farmers. Has anybody heard of our work before? Thanks, guys. and we are a statewide nonprofit that does small and mid-sized, highly diversified, and local market farmers. We do technical assistance and advocacy. So we run a couple of farmer programs that I won't talk too much about now, but there's materials on our table outside if you'd like to talk to me about land access or regenerative pasture management. We have programs for that. But today I'm here to talk about our advocacy work because we are incredibly lucky here in the Willamette Valley to be able to grow the diversity of what the USDA calls specialty seeds. Specialty crops and specialty seeds, according to the USDA, is literally all fruits and vegetables. If it's not corn, soy, or wheat, it is a specialty crop. So when we say specialty seeds, we mean all the fruits and vegetables that make up your nutrient needs. We grow an incredible diversity of seeds here in the Willamette Valley and up and down the Green Corridor, which includes like the Skagit Valley in Washington up to British Columbia. So because of the soil we have here, the geologic formations that we have that allow for isolation between different types of seeds so that they can grow different types of crops and not, because they are open pollinated, like we learned in this movie, not cross with each other too much. And we have historically been a really rich seed growing region. And here in the US, we have some slightly different problems than the ones that you saw in the film just now. We don't have to protect our agriculture necessarily from the government pushing corporations on it. We have to ask the government to protect us from the corporations pushing themselves on us on their own. So there's a slightly different way that we have to go about combating corporate agribusiness here in the US because we have had a takeover of monocrop agriculture here. It's really amazing to see in the film that in Africa, there's still 60 to 70% of all the food eaten by people is produced by smallholders, small producers. That's incredible. Unfortunately, that's not the case here. We in the US are much further into a monocrop society, so we have to protect the diversity of our agriculture from the influence of monocrop agribusiness in many different ways. And so one of those ways is preserving our ability to grow specialty brassica seed here in the Willamette Valley. Brassica is a plant family. Does anybody know? Shout out a brassica if you know one. Broccoli, yeah. So all the things that are related to broccoli, like cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, mustards, turnips. There's a lot of things in the brassica family that folks don't realize are all in there, but it all comes down from some genetically related plants. And when you get down to it, when it's like how you make a golden doodle. All dogs can crossbreed with each other and create viable offspring because they have common ancestors. So same thing with brassicas. They have common ancestors, and at a certain point, they can cross with each other and create a different brassica. But here in the Willamette Valley, we grow over 90% of the entire seed stock of some varieties of brassicas. So to continue these heirloom open pollinated varieties and make sure that these nutrient-dense heirloom, like really incredible types of food are still available generally to the whole world, we need to be able to ensure that we can grow what we intend to when we're growing seed. Canola is also a brassica. Yes, canola is in that same family. And here in the Willamette Valley, we have what's called the Willamette Valley Protected District. For the last 12 years, there has been very limited canola production here in the Willamette Valley. It's limited to 500 acres, and you have to apply for a permit from the Department of Agriculture. Last year, when we went to the legislature to renew that limit and to push that sunset out again, as we have every 4 years for the last 12 years, we were met with a renewed campaign against canola limits. And they were successful in only pushing that sunset 1 year and requiring a work group that will fundamentally change how canola is managed in the Willamette Valley Protected District. We are not the only protected district in the state. There is also a protected district in Central Oregon in the Bend area, which is incredibly important because there's a lot of indigenous community seed saving that goes on in that area. There's a nexus there of a lot of different seed sovereignty organizations in the Bend area. Those also exist in the Willamette Valley, but it's really important that we preserve these seed producing regions. Everywhere else in the state, there is no limit on where and how canola can be grown. It's only in these very, very productive seed producing regions that we have to be more conscious of the cross-pollination that can happen when we're talking about these open pollinated heirloom and often organic seeds. So right now we are developing a new solution, hopefully, that will preserve our ability to grow organic open pollinated brassica seed here in the Willamette Valley so that folks can continue to grow those types of food here in Oregon, around the country, and in some cases, we are the place that produces these varieties for the whole world. So there's a QR code up here. There's also one on the table outside. And if you would like to stay apprised of the campaign and lend your voice when the time comes to say, hey, we would rather have more diversity of brassica seed production than only have canola. Because the reason that we're so concerned about canola is that it is, one, it's a very, very aggressive cross-pollinator. It is part of a species, well, there's a couple of different types of canola, and they're both in species that are very easily transmitted, I guess is a word for it. But there's, I can talk more about the science outside, but They are very readily crossable with many different types of food crops. They also, the way that canola works, it has seed banking potential that once that seed is stored, if the soil, it can be stored in the soil, and if the soil is disturbed, years later it can keep coming up. It also is an oilseed crop. So the mutual destruction principle that seed growers currently have with each other doesn't apply to folks who are growing canola. Because if, hey, if I am growing a type of cabbage, and Osana and Alva are growing a type of broccoli, and we know that those could cross-pollinate, then we both have an incentive to communicate and to isolate those crops from each other, so that when we send off our seed at the end of the season, we don't both end up with a half cabbage, half broccoli, because then the seed would be rejected, no one would get what they want, and people wouldn't have that cabbage and that broccoli. So we both have an incentive to isolate and to talk to our neighbors and make sure that that seed grows what we want it to grow. If I am a canola grower and I just want my seed to go to the oil pressing facility and it doesn't matter what grows out of it, I don't have the same risk factor. So there is not that principle of mutually assured destruction there. So proliferation of canola in the Willamette Valley really threatens our ability to maintain the seed stock for the future of our nutrition, of our agricultural system, and to preserve biodiversity in our food system at large. So that is the biggest thing that we're working on in the 2024 short session. If you have any interest in legislative advocacy for farm issues based on small and mid-sized, highly diversified and local market farmers, that's how we identify our folks, but we represent about 1,600 farmers across the state, the kind of folks who you see at the farmers market, who you get your CSA from, and who run your local U-Pick. So if you would like to hear more, I'll be outside in the lobby. And now I will take your questions, I guess, if there's any questions that folks have about it. I'm just that thorough.
That was really thorough and informative, and now I have a lot to think about Roscoe's. But yeah. I'm wondering, this is amazing. Thank you for this information. This is exactly in alignment with the film. Is there any other things that your organization is working on that we can apply efforts towards that perhaps don't involve this challenge at the moment?
Yes. I have some copies of our 2024 legislative platform out on the table. But we're also working on land access. We run Oregon FarmLink, which is a program where you can list land or look for land in order to find your land for your farm or pass on your land to someone who will fulfill your stewardship plan going forward. And we are supporting efforts to make conservation easements and succession planning more accessible so that we can keep our very high quality farmland here in Oregon in production, away from development, and to help farmers find a way to retire that is not just passing it to your children who may or may not want to farm and then having it be subdivided and everyone fights and it's bad. So conservation easements are a way to permanently protect farmland. Conservation easements cannot be undone. They are attached to the deed of your land and can dictate, oh, this land has to be used for agricultural production for the rest of eternity. And it has to be used with these conservation practices so you can enshrine your stewardship plan forever and always. So we work on that. We also have a program called Oregon Pasture Network, which is a community practice and you know, marketing platform for pasture-based meat producers. So if you eat animal products of any kind, we have meat folks, we have fiber folks. If you're looking for a new source of wool or alpaca fleece, we have dairy folks, we have eggs and all, you know, anything that can come from a farm animal. But these folks are raising their animals on pasture in rotational grazing systems with an eye toward soil carbon sequestration and climate change mitigation through using animals as part of a full system on the farm. If you're interested in that, you can go to OregonPastureNetwork.org, type in your zip code and find a member in your area. We have quite a few in the Lane County, Lane Lynn Benton County area. So. Do that. Yeah.
How many of your members are doing regenerative farming?
Yeah, so we don't require certifications with our membership, but so I don't have like the number, but regenerative agriculture is a set of principles. And those are the principles that our organization is founded on. So we like to think of ourselves as a trade organization for the non-conventional farmer. So people using organic practices, people who are regenerative, people who are using indigenous technical knowledge and traditional knowledge and intergenerational knowledge to steward their land. So I would be comfortable saying at least 95, maybe 100%.
And does Oregon State University, are they, I mean, would you say that they're kind of organically oriented or more big ag oriented?
I would say that because they are a public university, even though they don't get the majority of their funding from the public anymore, their programs are very heavy into conventional agriculture. And that can be very easily evidenced through the distribution of extension agents, I guess is a good way to put it. For example, on the livestock side, first of all, there's like 186 extension agents across the state. I just had to do a presentation on this for legislators, so I know my numbers. The 186 extension agents across the state, 17 of those have pasture and forage experience. So about 9% of the total capacity of OSU Extension can say anything about raising an animal outside, not in a confinement area, and only one person is designated as an organic pasture specialist in the entire state. His name is Dr. Cheyenne Gajar, and he specializes in warm season grasses that tolerate droughts. He's brilliant, you should look into his work, but he cannot be everywhere all the time. So I would say the Center for Small Farms at OSU does a lot of great work. They put on a lot of educational programming. If any aspiring farmers are out there in the crowd, you should 100% go to the Small Farms Conference in February in Corvallis. It's always a good time. You learn so much. But in general, OSU's resources do cater toward a conventional ag system.
So small family farms on the rise? Have we reached peak commercial farm? Or?
Hard to say. I think that without... So just like you saw in the film, subsidies and government intervention and government infrastructure determine a lot of what farming is possible. Because it's not only, at least here in this country, we have quite a lot of regulation after you produce the product, before, like between the making of it and the bringing it to market. And in order to truly shift our system, we also have to shift all the infrastructure between farm and market toward a small producer. Because right now, all of our transport, all of our like meat processing, for example, all of our hazelnut drying even, is geared toward an economy of scale that smallholder farmers are not going to meet. It's only going to be those conventional, like hundreds and hundreds of acre farmers, like the crops that we talked about in the monoculture, and also canola is a great example of a crop that's only profitable on a hundreds of acre scale. But the infrastructure between the farm and the market is much more geared toward that large scale. So I would say that until we shift that, we have not seen the peak of corporate agribusiness in this country. So that's a lot of what we focus on.
Well, but you say subsidy, so that means our tax dollars are mm-hmm. funding a antiquated
yes, sir.
System. Can you want to elaborate on that?
Sure.
I mean, you just did, but if you can give me more on our tax dollars.
Yeah. So any government program, a lot of what we do is equitable resource distribution, and by equitable, you mean according to the need. Not everyone gets the same thing. And so when we think about equitable resource distribution in government programming, for example, like farm subsidies, we think about the farm bill that comes up every 5 years. We're about to go into another farm bill cycle on the federal level. And the amount that is given to subsidies versus the amount that is put into conservation programs and the local access market programs, the LAMP programs, it's something like 15-fold difference, which is insane. And all of that money, when we're talking about USDA programs, is government revenue, which means our taxes. So anytime you're thinking about a USDA program, if we can realign those programs to give more toward a community food system and less left over for a conventional agribusiness-focused food system, then we are shifting that infrastructure question. So that's why we talk about, I feel like all I do in my advocacy is ask for money sometimes, but that is a crucial part of shifting how farms are possible in this country, because we talk about this all the time. There are like 30,000 farms in Oregon. The vast majority of them, something like 25,000 farms, are under 100 acres. But are those farms supporting that household fully? A lot of those farms have off-farm income because it's not possible in the system we live in right now for all of those folks to rely solely on their farm income. And the more that we make small farming a viable business and people can actually support themselves and not have to rely on another remote job or doing something on the side or all of those other things, the more that we will build the system that we want to live in. So it's thinking about things like business viability, like the infrastructure between the farm and the market, and getting folks an equitable playing field when it comes to government investment.
I got one more, another strange, all right, here's a strange question.
Yeah. Okay,
but I think you'll like it. It's how do they perform after a disaster? You know, when you mention infrastructure, I would think a small farm would come back sooner after a disaster.
Yeah.
So isn't it for our own safety?
I think disaster resilience is a big part of what we saw during COVID. For example, like in the beginning of COVID, when anxiety and panic were at its height, we had a lot of empty grocery store shelves. But guess what? We're still open, largely because of the Oregon Farmers Market Association, who I will plug till the day I die. They got farmers markets designated as essential businesses early in the pandemic, so they were allowed to remain open, because an open air farmers market where that stuff is not relying on travel infrastructure or transportation infrastructure, rather, across the country, across the world, where you're bringing your, like, you're driving your box truck from your farm less than 50 miles to the market. You have everything with you. You are contained. You go to an open air market where people don't have to worry about that enclosed, highly contagious space. And when we think about COVID, the local food systems especially were the ones who were able to pivot toward mutual aid. So they had the flexibility. They weren't growing on contract for Tyson or something like that, where they had already sunk all of that money and they were locked into, they would be in a legal battle for the rest of their lives if they deviated from that contract. But local growers who are selling direct to consumer have the flexibility to be there for their communities when they're needed. And also they can pivot toward, you know, whatever outlets are available. Like if all grocery stores shut down due to a natural disaster, we have farmers here, we're very, very lucky here in the Willamette Valley to have a thriving community food system where these farmers can show up for you in any place that we make available to them. So I think that disaster resilience and being able to have the flexibility, the freedom and the mobility to be where you're needed is a huge argument in favor of the community food system. Alva.
Mine's not much of a question, more of a statement that ties it all together a little bit.
Yes, please.
I was a farmer during the pandemic. We showed up at the farmer's market every single week. We still continue to do so. We can't farm produce without seed.
So true.
We can't turn to our farmers for food if our farmers don't have access to seed. And that's open pollinated, genetically integrative seed. We can't produce it. It's just as simple as it gets.
Very true.
We can't produce food without seed.
Seed is the building block and it expands exponentially. I think it was you all that I was talking to when you were talking about how satisfying it is as a seed farmer to like get your one, not even a square foot of seed, to grow out and then return a pallet of seed that then can turn into millions of pounds of food. And that is something that doesn't happen in other parts of our food system. And we're so lucky that like the nutritional density that can be created from one pallet of organic vegetable seed, not just brassica, all vegetable seed grown here in the Willamette Valley can produce so much nutritionally dense, like life-sustaining food.
Is there a seed swap coming up?
A seed swap, ooh. I don't know. I know that there was one.
The Agrarian Sharing Network.
They had one back in March that I went to, which was really good, but I don't know when their next one is, but the Agrarian Sharing Network does the biggest seed swaps in this area.
Is that at the, what was the beer?
I don't have any flyers for them, but I will I will make sure you get connected with them. Cool.
Thank you, Alan.
You're welcome, Alba. Thanks, y'all. Have a good night.
Are you even listening to friends of family farmers from the Eugene Environmental Film Festival at the Bijou Art House? You can get more information at friendsoffamilyfarmers.org. So now this is David Zupan from Eugene Peaceworks on a little history about rent in Eugene, rental property in Eugene, and the price of housing in Eugene. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. KPW, LP, 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio. All right, so I'm talking with David Zupan. What are your credentials? What credentials do you want me to use with for you, David?
Oh, well, I've been an activist in town for many years, and I'm currently on the board of Eugene Peaceworks, which has as one of its primary projects, KPW Community Radio, which we're very proud of.
All right, so I sent an email to the to our news list about, because the rent strike was busted here in Eugene yesterday. So I was looking for past histories, and you reminded me of Amazon Housing. Can you tell me what happened with Amazon Housing?
Actually, it was back in the 70s, and it was Amazon refers to the Amazon family, student family housing that was under the University of Oregon. And it was there for many years, using World War II shipbuilders, buildings that were shipped down from Vanport. I think they got it for a ridiculously low amount of money. And it was put up on the site where Spencer View apartments are now. And there were 48 buildings, and most importantly, it was initially for GIs and their families so they could come back to and get their education after the war. But it evolved into a real community of both undergrad and graduate students and their families. And it tended to be a place where, because it was so large, there were a lot of people who knew a lot about different areas, including how to do self administration. And so people became very interested in making sure that the place continued as a low-income housing resource. But the university had other plans. They kept talking about it being temporary housing that they were going to tear down and replace. And that was a long time debate, struggle between the residents there who wanted to keep it indefinitely because they saw how valuable a resource it was, and the administration of the university. So one of the things they would do is not maintain the place very well. And so the rent strike evolved when they threatened to have increase the rent. That was a relatively small amount, but every dollar counted back then as well as it does now. And folks were organized enough to call for a rent strike, which involved people, instead of paying their rent, put the money into an escrow fund that was created. And we used that as a bargaining chip. And it went on for several months, and it got to the point where we had about $20,000 in there, which back then was quite a bit of money, back in the 70s. And, well, it's still quite a bit of money, but the university did negotiate then, and did, we didn't stop the rent increase, which was $2.50, but we did get a daycare center. They agreed to build a daycare center on the site and a playground, and also gave us more autonomy in helping to run the place, giving us a more of a voice in its how it was run. So we saw it as a real victory. And on the eve of our turning the money over to the university at Oregon Hall, one of our artists activists said, well, since it's such a large amount of money, why don't I make a large check? So she created a replica of a check that was 5 feet long and three feet tall. And so we took that into Oregon Hall, went up to the counter and presented it. And the clerk there said, well, we can't accept that. And we said, oh, okay. And so we all started, there were several of us, we all started walking out the door. Just before we got to the door, somebody yelled out, no, no, come back, we'll accept it, it's fine. So we got a good laugh out of that. And it was a real lesson for me personally, because it was my first real action where I saw how people, when they take action collectively, can really make a difference. If you try to do it by yourself, more difficult, if not impossible sometimes. So the power of collective action for social change was dramatically taught to me. And that began, actually it helped influence my being involved in activism for the rest of my life.
Well, and so I just want to explain, though, you held the check back, showing them that you have the money to pay the rent if they would just meet some reasonable demands that of making the place habitable, that you had the money sitting right there in account if they would just meet your demands. That was the purpose of holding that escrow account, right?
Well, yes, and they had already agreed to that. We'd already finished the negotiation. They had already agreed to made the concessions. So this was more symbolic, our walking in with the check. I mean, that actually was the transaction of giving them the money, but it was a misunderstanding by one clerk about how thinking that you couldn't take a check in that form. But actually, you can. I guess checks can be written on just about anything.
But I mean, the escrow account, you had money in an escrow account to show that you were willing to pay the rent. It wasn't, you weren't just trying to get out of paying rent.
Oh, yeah, no, they knew that. They knew we had such a fund, and so that helped with the negotiating process.
So then, because I met you in the 90s over Amazon Housing when they wanted to move these buildings that you're talking about. Must have been structurally sound, right? Because they can't move a building that is not structurally sound. So what did they want to do? So they basically moved most of these buildings and got rid of them and then raised the rents, and they make more profit because these rents are higher, and because profits are a percentage of rent, they make more money. The university makes more money by charging higher rents with supposedly better quality buildings.
Right. Yeah. In actual fact, they wanted to tear down all the buildings, and that was in the 90s when, after I had already graduated, but I was living out in the community and heard about this this happening again, and I joined with students and others from the community to basically do what we had done before, which was resist what the university was planning. They basically wanted to tear the whole place down, all 48 buildings, and replace it with some what turned out to be ticky-tacky apartments. And yeah, it was going to be much higher rent, and that was our main issue. This is too valuable a housing resource. It was low-income housing that was affordable for students, including international students and single moms and so forth that live there. So it was a real community, and as had happened in the 70s, we had proposed a housing co-op that we would, the university would retain ownership, but we would basically manage it, run the whole place for them. And we would also renovate all the buildings. It was in need of renovation because the university hadn't maintained it that well. We went out and found the funding in the community, several million dollars actually, and said, okay, let's do this. The university initially said yes, as they had done back in the 70s. And so we put in thousands of volunteer hours to get ready for this to happen. And on the eve of the of that transition, when we would the co-op would begin, they backtracked. They reneged on the agreement. And it was the same person who was involved in both the 70s and in the 90s. His name was Frommeyer, you may remember. Mm-hmm. Some folks will remember. And he was an attorney, and he knew he could do this. And I think in many ways it was not just an economic thing to raise, make more money. It was a political decision, because Amazon was a real bastion, you might say, of liberal, if not radical, community organizers. Many of them, you know, obviously very well educated. And this was a way of eliminating that kind of activism. So we resisted the effort to do this, of course. In fact, some people dropped out right away because they were so surprised, shocked that the university had done this. But many of us who had been involved in the 70s recognized the same pattern. You make a promise, then you renege on it at the last minute, hoping that your opposition would be so discouraged they'll give up. Well, we were ready for this, and that began a two-year campaign of resistance. That included the creation of, we found out that the Amazon qualified as a National Historic Landmark District because it was such a, it was one of the last housing resources of its kind that was set up for GIs to be able to get their education. And so it was one of the last of these GI student communities, family student communities still remaining, with and so large, you know, with 48 buildings, 250 units, all, as you said, very well made. They had been made with old growth timber up in Portland at Vanport, and then they had been trucked down here. They had to be very well made. As it turns out, we got the National Historic Landmark status, which isn't that easy. We had to do a lot of paperwork and meet all the requirements. Part of the reason we did that is to make that was one of the tools we had to try to protect Amazon from being demolished. Well, as you are very familiar, the state, or the university in this case, has a lot of clout, and they were determined, Frommeyer was determined to move ahead with this. So he kept pushing ahead, and we kept resisting. Even after National Historic Landmark, he basically got the city of Eugene, which initially had supported the historic landmark effort, got them to cooperate with him as well as the state, because it was a public resource, housing historic resource. The university was required by law to put it up for sale instead of demolishing it, if that was their plan, and which it was, because we had raised the money necessary to renovate the place, we offered to buy it outright. So they had to take our offer up, and their counter offer was the, what they did was they built in a loophole, and the loophole was they would sell the property, but there was 18 acres there, and we had to pay the amount, but we also had to come up with the same amount of land that Amazon sat on, these 18 acres.
Right, mitigation.
Yeah, and it had to be within 2 miles of 13th and Alder. Well, as we all know, there isn't that amount of vacant land within that 2 miles. So basically what it was a loophole, and because the university had the influence of, by that time they were using the Justice Department, the state, power of the state as well, and so they had state attorneys working on this. We took it all the way to LUBA, the Land Use Appeals Board, and they basically ruled that that loophole was okay, because they said, oh, well, they were required to put it up for sale, and they did that. And but so even though there was no way we could meet that requirement of the land exchange, they ruled that that was valid. Well, that was ridiculous.
Because anybody they put it up for sale for would have had to have purchased a mitigation field, or yeah. No matter who they sold it to, they would have had to still done the mitigation. So, and it wasn't that the mitigation was not affordable, it was that the mitigation was not available. So how is that fair? So that seems like a double standard, yeah.
There was also a PR battle going on, right? They were making the argument that, oh, these are old broken down buildings. They aren't suitable, they should be replaced. And that was their PR spin. And we, of course, were countering that these buildings are completely subject to renovation, and we'll do the renovation. We did have a lot of support in the community as well as on campus, but basically the university proceeded ahead, and I think we did appeal it, and while it was under appeal, they started demolishing the place, and some members of the community even went, and we had what was called the Amazon 9, who they were folks who went down to the site and blocked the bulldozers for the day. That one of them was former city councilor Kevin Hornbuckle. They had their day in court, but and it was a very courageous action on their part. And I think if we perhaps had more of that and continued, we may have been able to, and maybe more of it sooner. Hard to know. It's hard to second guess what could have worked, but long story short, or it's a long story shorter, they did demolish all the buildings. The other part of their spin was, oh, we won't tear all the buildings down. We'll set aside 8 of the buildings, and they'll we're going to give some to St. Vincent's, and then some to a developer who's going to put them up, and that was kind of what they used to a bone thrown out to the community to use in their PR fight against us. And it worked. And they did manage to tear down all 40 of the buildings. It was a huge resource and a waste of low-income housing. That's one of the reasons we have, I think, shortages today, is because people didn't have the foresight to keep Amazon. And as it turned out, if we have proof of that even today, that these places were completely restorable. Those 8 buildings were moved, and you can see them today at the corner of 19th and Amazon. You can see the St. Vincent's units there. They're perfectly solid buildings that are working very well as low-income housing for St. Vincent's. And then down the street a ways at Ferry on 19th, I believe, there's an apartment complex made up of a couple of the Amazon buildings. So it showed that they had to do that at, you know, some expense to move them and then renovate them. But if they'd been renovated on site, the cost would have been much less. And of course, we had found the money to do it. The community had found the money to do it. So it was pretty outrageous that the University of Oregon under Frommeyer did this. It's a legacy of shame.
Well, so would you say the university is more interested in helping cheap rent and helping students, or are they more interested in maintaining their endowment?
That's pretty clear that, as we've seen borne out since from the 70s on up, basically the university is being privatized. It's the corporatization of universities across the country, but particularly at the U of O, as was well documented in the book many of your listeners may have read or heard about. It's called The University of Nike, and it's all about that process and how it's been carried out. So it's not surprising, but I think the real story is the vibrant resistance that Eugene and the Amazon community united around. The campaign, it was over 2 years of very hard work, and it was revived again when the university did the same thing with Westmoreland in the 90s, when they privatized that whole student complex. I was involved in that campaign as well, which also, again, had probably even more support from obviously the campus, but also the community. And that too went all the way to the State Board of Higher Education, where folks from the community went and said, hey, don't privatize this. We need this lower income housing because we're students, we're poor, there was single moms, again, international students. It was the same story all over again. I think it was having a real impact on the board. You know, we've done a lot of lobbying around it. But then Frommeyer got up in front of the state board and said, we'll take care of these students. Don't worry. And we'll keep the rents. We'll make sure they keep the rents low or some. But he was basically arguing that he was putting his reputation on the line. He spoke himself before the state board, using all he could of his role as president to make sure that this process went through of privatizing Westmoreland, which again was another outrageous privatization of a public resource that was basically stolen from the community and contributed to the, I think, the shortage of low-income, affordable housing in this community.
Final question. Do rent strikes work?
Yes, they can work. They can work. It's important to have a lot of participation and a lot of community support, obviously. The struggle goes on. I encourage folks to stay united, work together.
System. It was a body remover. I'll give you a dose, spread it. U.S. presidents, as were applied to the Nazis after World War II, that every single one of them, every last rich white one of them from Truman on, would have been hung to death and shot. And this current administration is no exception. It should be hung and tried and shot. As any war criminal should be. But the challenges that we face, they go way beyond administrations, way beyond elections, way beyond every 4 years of pulling levers, way beyond that. Because this whole rotten system has become so vicious and cruel that in order to sustain itself, it needs to destroy entire countries and profit from their reconstruction in order to survive. And that's not a system that changes every 4 years. It's a system that we have to break down generation after generation after generation after generation.